Patience.
Cease making all that noise at once.
A voice like a smurf scolded him.
Do you want to summon every dark one in the forest?
Jazz shook his head. Whatever kind of invisible creature this was, standing on his chest, kidnapping him, having Boar drag him through the forest, and scolding him for talking, Jazz preferred it immensely to feeling the soul-chilling touch of a dark one again. Cooper had taken down a few more of them, but one of them had managed to touch Jazz again before Cooper could finish it off. He barely had the strength to stand up, even if he wasn't tied to a sled. He was curious, however, and risked a whisper.
Who are you?
The two indentations on Chaz's shirt disappeared. A couple of seconds later, an orange-haired head materialized above Chaz's face. It was small, like a baby's, but its elf-like features were adult. Then the rest of its body appeared. Yellow gossamer wings and leather armor, painted bright green and pink and adorned with orange wildflowers. Chaz supposed that camouflage wasn't a huge concern for a creature that could turn invisible at will. The small flying man knocked an arrow and narrowed his eyes at Chaz.
I'm the one who's going to shoot you to sleep again if you don't shut your trap.
He was more intimidating than anyone dressed like that had any business being. Chaz nodded, and the little flying man flew ahead, landed on the back of the boar, then vanished. With few other viable options, Chaz tried to relax and enjoy the ride.
The fuck?
Said Cooper a few minutes later.
What the? Who? Son of a bitch! Fuck this shit! I'm really angry!
Snap! Snap, snap! Snap, snap, snap! Chaz heard more chords popping. These little flying fuckers hadn't counted on barbarian rage. Cooper roared as individual pops turned into one big rip. He must have gotten an arm free.
Halt!
Cried another smurf voice.
The big one's loose!
The boar-driven caravan came to a halt. Zanzaferl's sled pulled up to Chaz's left side, and Cooper's sled, now empty but for some strands of frayed twine, pulled up on his right.
I told you we should have used more rope on him. We used all we had. More rope for one would have meant less for the other two.
Look at the dandy one. One strand would have been enough to bind his hands together.
Chaz was a little annoyed, wondering whether or not they knew his strength had been sapped by dark ones.
Fuck you, talking pigs,
cried Cooper as he leapt onto a boar's back and started punching it in the head.
Cooper,
said Chaz. There wasn't much point in keeping quiet now.
It's not the boar, it's...
Where are we?
Said Zanzaferl. The sound of squealing pigs in Cooper's barrage of profanity had roused him from his slumber.
It's too dark. We have to get out of here. The dark ones!
Twang. Twang, 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 twang. Similar to how the popping strands of Cooper's bindings had sounded, a series of releasing bowstrings rang out. It was almost musical. Cooper stood up from the pig he'd been beating, his eyes crossing as his rage-enhanced muscles deflated. The accompanying fart whisked away any hint of music from the air, replacing it with Cooper's signature brand of chemical warfare. Once he'd collapsed, presumably full of invisible NyQuil-tipped arrows, the smurf voices groaned from a little higher up and farther away than they had been. Even Zanzaferl's eyes teared up as he scrunched his nose.
By the gods! How can something so vile be contained within...
Zanzaferl's eyes widened and focused solidly in one direction.
There! In those bushes! I saw one! Children of the forest, I beg you! Please don't let it take me!
I see it,
said one of the smurf's voices.
Spread out. I'll take the target position.
Chaz spotted the dark one. It was coming right for him. Being the weakest, he was the likeliest target. He wanted to shout, but he was too terrified to speak.
Now!
Cried the smurf voice, which had called the target position. A second later, the quickly darkening forest flashed a light with five bolts of green lightning, fanning out from a point right behind the dark one to five points up in the air. The dark one lit up like a filament bulb, exposing the horrified and anguished face of whomever it used to be for a fraction of a second, then disintegrated into a mist of darkness.
Put the big one back on the sled,
said a voice that Chaz thought was the same one who had taken the target position, but he couldn't be sure.
Use what you have to keep him from falling off. He should still be asleep long after we reach the glade. We'll bind him more securely then.
Everyone on three,
said another smurf voice, this one female.
One, two, three.
Cooper's arms and legs rose from the ground. Then, between at least a dozen grunts and the swarm-like din of furiously flapping wings, his entire body was levitating.
"Gently, gently,"
said the female voice as Cooper floated over the sled.
"Very good, now."
Cooper let out another fart. This one was long and wet-sounding.
"Wow!"
cried at least four of the winged people as Cooper's ass fell down hard. A loud crack came from the sled.
"Nuts and berries,"
said the female voice. That was the most adorable swearing Chaz had ever heard.
"Now what do we do?"
"What is it you want from us?" asked Chaz.
"I thought I'd made it clear,"
said the voice that had told Chaz to shut up.
"That I want you to shut up."
"I'm just saying, if you don't intend to hurt us, I'm sure we'd all prefer to follow you than stay out here with the Dark Ones. If you untie us, we'll happily go wherever you tell us to."
"Should we trust them? I don't see how we have much of a choice now that the sled is broken. We could leave them here."
"Hickory Nut, shame on you."
"I didn't suggest we do that. I was just laying out all the options."
"They wouldn't survive the night out here."
"But what if they're agents of the Dark Lord?" "They don't look like agents of the Dark Lord. If they are, perhaps the Dark Lord is not as powerful as we thought."
"No satyr would betray his fellow fey."
"Ha! A satyr would betray his own mother for a cup of wine and a gourd to poke his pecker in."
"Hey!" said Zanzifurl. It was getting darker, and Chaz was more and more nervous with each flicker of genuine shadow.
"Whatever you guys are going to do, can you please go ahead and do it?"
"He's right. Whippoorwillow, Honeydrop, and Huckleberry, tie the two remaining sleds side by side."
"Yes, Tollywhirl."
"Dimplethorn, Cinnamon, and Wildflower, hitch Stuffles and Pork Pie together with the other boar."
Right away, Hollywhirl.
As sleds, strings, and pig harnesses began to move around seemingly of their own accord, a female pixie appeared directly above Chaz's face. She had pink hair and wore yellow and green leather armor. She gave Chaz a stern look and held up a warning finger.
"Don't you make me regret this."
She turned invisible again, but Chaz could feel the wind from her wings blowing against his face. A moment later, he was able to move his arms. The strings which had been binding them to his sides were now loose. Sitting up felt like he was wearing a sweater made out of lead. Walking felt like he was wearing cinder blocks on his feet. Those Dark Ones had done a number on him. He didn't know if he'd be able to walk as far as he needed to.
"There's another one!"
cried Zanzifurl, pointing at a tree now that his bindings had been loosened.
"Hurry! Use your magic lightning again!"
"We just used the last one we had for the day,"
said Hollywhirl.
"Then wake up the half-orc and give him his axe."
"Absolutely not."
Chaz finally spotted the Dark One. They were so much more difficult to see with all the natural shadows growing longer and darker as the sun set. Like all the others, it was headed his way. He tried to back away from it, but every step was a struggle.
"Pixie people,"
he said, keeping his eyes on the Dark One as it crept toward him.
"Please tell me you have another option."
"Ready?"
said one of the pixies from over by the sleds.
"Grab your half-orc friend,"
said Hollywhirl.
"Get on the sled."
"I barely had the strength to move myself. Those things touched me."
"Nuts and berries,"
Hollywhirl sighed.
"Everyone, help me put the half-orc on the sled."
There was a quiet din of murmuring as all the disembodied voices gathered around Cooper's unconscious body again.
"His skin is so sticky. I don't want to touch his foot again."
"Those arms aren't much better. He'd better not fart on me again."
"Everyone grab his arms," said Zanzifurl. "I'll get his feet."
With Zanzifurl holding Cooper by the feet and a bunch of invisible pixies holding up his top half, it created the illusion that Zanzifurl was incredibly strong and Cooper was incredibly stiff, and they were performing some kind of impossible feat of acrobatics.
"Gods have mercy," said Zanzifurl as they hauled Cooper onto the sled. "I might have preferred touching the Dark One."
Having experienced both, Chaz couldn't even bring himself to joke about it. He gratefully endured his close proximity to Cooper on the sled.
"Hurry!" cried Zanzifurl. "Two more approach, and those are just the ones I can see."
"Go!"
said Hollywhirl, and the boar started running like they'd been shot out of a cannon. Even if his own strength wasn't currently compromised, Chaz had a new appreciation for the power in those short piggy legs. He let himself relax a little as they outran the Dark Ones. Then he jumped when Hollywhirl's head and wings appeared in front of his face. She was flying behind the sled, and pixies could apparently choose what parts of their bodies they wanted to be invisible.
I don't personally believe you're aligned with the Dark Lord,
she said to Chaz and Zanzafurl. This wood is my home, said Zanzafurl. I would never betray it. Chaz shrugged.
I don't even know who the Dark Lord is.
And I believe you both,
said Hollywhirl.
But I cannot allow you to know the way to our Glade of Sanctuary.
Well, that's reasonable, said Chaz. You don't know us, and you can't be too careful. So what, you want us to put on blindfolds or something?
Or something.
The rest of Hollywhirl's body appeared, and she was holding a bow in one hand and an arrow in the other. Quick as the wind, she fired the arrow into Zanzafurl's chest, and he slumped over unconscious. She drew another arrow and smiled sympathetically at Chaz.
Wait, said Chaz. I could just close my...
It barely felt worse than a mosquito bite, but Chaz's eyelids now felt as heavy as the rest of him. His vision turned fuzzy, then dark, then nothing. Chapter 24 Dave knocked on the door of the Horse Head Inn. It budged open an inch. No one was manning the entrance, and it was quiet inside. The smell was familiar, but not as pungent with body odor. His heart quickened as he feared the worst.
Hello?
He called in.
The door's open, Frank grumbled back. Either come in or fuck off.
That was slightly reassuring. Dave led Murkwort inside and found Frank, Rhonda, and Tony the Elf slouching at the bar, staring into their drinks. They appeared to be the only ones there. The rest of the common area looked like a restaurant that was either closed for the night or had gone out of business. The stools sat upside down on top of the tables. A pile of broken glass had been swept into a corner and left there. A dead rat was pinned to the wall with a crossbow bolt. Judging by the state of it, it had been there for a few days.
I was worried for a second, said Dave. I thought the place was abandoned or Mordred Head.
He didn't even want to finish the thought.
Where is everybody?
Frank let out a shallow laugh.
This is everybody. Where are all the others? I mean the ones who stuck around after you.
There was no respectful way to end that sentence.
After I lost my shit? Frank shrugged. They could be anywhere. They made it a point not to say. We all had a big talk after you left. I'm sorry to tell you, but the consensus was that you and the bard guy would most likely fuck things up even worse than they are now. And there was a good possibility that Mordred would get his dice back.
Dave sighed.
Oh, thank you for that vote of confidence. Rather than being sitting ducks here, we decided that everyone should split off into groups of two or three and go their separate ways. Some had it in their heads that they'd go out and gain some levels until they were powerful enough to stand up to Mordred, that we should have been doing that with the horsemen before. Others were just tired of having their hopes repeatedly crushed. They went out to try to make some sort of lives for themselves here. What about the three of you?
We're the sitting ducks, said Tony the Elf. In the off chance that you two idiots managed to pull off some miracle, someone needed to stay behind and wait for you to come back.
He looked Murkwort up and down.
You haven't introduced your friend here. I trust he isn't a super chill Mordred.
This is Murkwort, said Dave. He's the one that Catherine's friend sold the dice to.
Frank perked up. He gawked at Murkwort with wide eyes.
Do you still have them?
Murkwort cleared his throat.
I'm afraid not. I mounted them on some jewelry and resold them to rich wizards on the Crescent Shadow.
Gah!
Shrieked Frank, shaking his little fists.
Do you have their names? Do you know how to find them?
As big an asshole as Frank had recently been, Dave felt bad about putting him through this.
They were anonymous transactions,
Murkwort nodded.
These aren't the sorts of people you want to go back on a deal with anyway. And if I expressed interest in reobtaining something so magical and mysterious, the price they would demand would be astronomical.
I feel it's worth noting, though,
said Dave.
I've thought about it quite a bit since I met Murkwort here, and there's no evidence to suggest that Tim was behind Catherine's friend swiping your dice bag.
Evidence? Cried Frank. He disappeared right after the dice did. How can you be so?
Frank's glare at Dave turned icier.
Wait a minute. You met with him, didn't you?
In a manner of speaking.
I knew it. He sold you some bullshit story about how he had nothing to do with it. He's totally innocent, and somebody's trying to set him up.
Frank shook his head.
I know you two go back a ways, but I don't understand. After everything you've seen him say and do here, how could you believe anything that comes out of his mouth?
Not his mouth, his throat, Dave sighed. Oh, I probably should have started with this part. It's been a crazy couple of days.
What is it?
Asked Rhonda.
Tim's dead. Mordred slit his throat in front of all of us, then kicked him off the flying island.
Frank finished the beer he'd been nursing, then set the glass down on the bar. I'm sorry for your loss. It doesn't prove his innocence, though. If anything, his being there at the same time as the dice is further evidence of his guilt, as far as I'm concerned.
Frank!
Rhonda scolded him. Am I wrong? Rhonda walked around the bar to refill her own glass.
It doesn't much matter now. Mordred was also on the island at the same time as the dice, and it's a more important matter for us to concentrate our concern on.
Mirkwart agreed to answer any questions we have about his transaction with the dice if we agree to answer his questions about what they are and where they came from.
What's left to ask? Said Tony the Elf. He's already told us that he doesn't know who he sold them to, and that we've got little to no chance of getting them back. The best we could hope for now is that these rich wizards are powerful enough to keep their new treasures out of Mordred's hands. And that best-case scenario still leaves us stranded here for the rest of our lives.
How can you say that after everything we've been through? Said Dave. Look at all the challenges we've overcome simply by not giving up immediately after a problem presents itself. Was this how you played Caverns and Creatures back home? You must have been the shittiest players in the world.
Anger flashed in Frank, Rhonda, and Tony the Elf's eyes. Dave had challenged their nerd integrity. Tony the Elf stood up.
Let's start with you then, idea man. What's your big idea?
My big idea was to bring Mirkwart here and try and come up with better ideas together.
Rhonda heaved a big resigned sigh through her nose, like she was about to say something she didn't want to say.
Dave's right. Look at us. We just got an opportunity thrown right onto our laps, and we didn't even put 10 seconds into thinking about how we might leverage it before instinctively concluding that it was another dead end.
She turned to Mirkwart.
You've got connections on the island, right?
Mirkwart pursed his lips.
I have a few.
Don't be so modest, said Dave. They call him Mirkwart the Magnificent.
Rhonda scratched her chin.
A wizard with that kind of influence might be able to convince the people he sold the dice to how dangerous they are in the wrong hands.
That's true, said Frank. And if Mordred knows about the dice, he'll be hunting them down as well. If we play our cards right, we might be able to catch Mordred in the act of trying to steal one of the dice. And with this guy as our ally, he gestured to Mirkwart, we stand a chance of swinging the fight in our favor. Tony the Elf nodded to himself.
We could actually come out of this with the dice and Mordred.
Dave felt like he just worked a minor miracle. He'd inspired optimism in some of the most defeatist sons of bitches he'd ever met. And although he knew that Frank and Tony the Elf were letting their imaginations run wild with unlikely specific scenarios, he allowed himself to join in their optimism that they might yet have a chance to return to the real world, and that Catherine might be able to have Tim resurrected. One day in the future, they might all be sitting around tables in the chicken hut, rolling mundane plastic dice, looking back on all this as a wild and fucked up memory. And Dave would think about this particular moment in time as the turning point at which he had rekindled hope, reigniting the fire that shed light on the path back home. He felt confident. He felt heroic, even. He felt some serious fucking pain in his abdomen.
Oh!
Groaned Dave, doubled over in agony.
Are you okay?
Asked Tony the Elf.
I don't know,
said Dave, panting to get the words out.
It's... maybe my appendix burst? What does that feel like?
Preposterous, said Mirkwart. Appendixes don't just spontaneously burst.
That's interesting to know.
Dave grabbed Mirkwart's arm to keep from falling over.
You're probably just experiencing gastrointestinal issues. When's the last time you relieved your bowels?
Mirkwart might have a point. Dave couldn't remember the last time he'd taken a shit. He hadn't exactly been eating regularly over the past couple of days. Maybe his insides were all fucked up from starvation, followed by all those fruity crescent shadow cocktails.
Is there a lavatory in here?
Murkwort asked the others.
There's an outhouse out back, said Frank, through that door.
Come on, then.
Murkwort guided Dave through the horse head inn from one opening to the other, as if they were enacting a macrocosm of the shit traveling through his own alimentary canal. By the time they made it through the back door, the pain had spread to the rest of his internal organs, and even out to his knees and elbows.
What the fuck is happening to me?
Dave wasn't sure if his shit was going to solve his problems, but if that's what it was going to take, it was going to be the biggest shit ever. Fortunately, by the light of the full moon, he was able to see that the scraps of fabric they used for toilet paper were in plentiful supply. The pain suddenly intensified tenfold. Dave's vision turned red as he felt like he was imploding and exploding at the same time. His bowels did, in fact, evacuate themselves, but it provided no relief. He thought he heard the distant sound of Murkwort screaming as his consciousness slipped away. Chapter 25. 5 bars had produced nothing except a puddle of vomit in the alley between the last two of them. Julian couldn't handle his morning liquor. Stacy wasn't thrilled to be rocking a Saturday night buzz on the mid-morning of whatever the fuck day this was, especially since they weren't getting any information out of it. But what could they do but persevere? The sign outside the next bar on the strip, the Mortar and Pestle, exuded more of a pharmacy vibe than a place-to-get-shit-faced vibe, but it could also be meant to appeal to wizards looking for an alchemical mix of booze.
I don't think I can do this again, said Julian.
Come on, soldier.
Stacy gently shook him until his eyes focused on hers.
We need your diplomacy.
She slapped him lightly on the cheek a couple of times.
It's like 8 o'clock in the fucking morning. If I see another shot of liquor right now, I'm gonna throw up again. That's gonna count as a penalty on my...
He let out a long, cavernous burp.
Diplomacy check.
The smell of that burp, having come from deep within him, convinced Stacy that he wasn't exaggerating.
Okay, sit this one out.
There was a courtyard in front of the Mortar and Pestle, surrounded by a 2-foot-high wall. Stacy considered laying Julian down next to the wall so that he wouldn't be visible from passers-by on the street, but her experience in this world so far told her that would all but guarantee they'd be separated.
Can you at least come inside? I'll put you in a booth, and you don't have to drink anything.
Julian nodded. It wasn't an ideal compromise. All the bartenders at this time of the morning were young, attractive women, no doubt meant to cajole every last copper piece out of the loneliest and drunkest men still managing to stumble from bar to bar. Stacy had been counting on Julian's male charms to likewise assist in cajoling information out of them. Maybe she'd get lucky, and this one would be into chicks. Supporting Julian by his arm over her shoulders, Stacy walked through the entrance of the Mortar and Pestle and immediately spotted 2 red flags. The first was the presence of another customer. It was more difficult and costlier to keep a bartender chatty when she had to divide her attention between multiple patrons. The well-dressed human man at the end of the bar only glanced her way briefly as she lugged Julian through the door. He looked like a young Richard Gere and was one of a very exclusive selection of men who could pull off a floppy beret and an ascot. The second red flag was the lack of enthusiasm in the bartender's greeting. It wasn't like the woman in the first bar who was simply in a rotten mood. The vibe Stacy was picking up from this girl was one of complete indifference. She didn't give a shit that 2 more customers had just walked in. This was just a job for her, and kind of a shitty one at that. As a disengaged graveyard shift employee, she was less likely to have knowledge Stacy was looking for. At least, that was Stacy's assessment of the situation, and she was making a lot of assumptions based on very little evidence. As long as she was here, she might as well find out what she could. She dumped Julian in a booth and took a stool at the bar.
Howdy!
The half-elven bartender meandered over with heavy eyes and sighed.
Oh, what can I get for you?
One of whatever you're having, said Stacy, trying to send out a vibe that could be misinterpreted as trying to be seductive.
I'm not having anything.
Ouch. A swing and a miss. Not only had Stacy failed to establish a friendly repartee,
but now she had to actually choose a drink. She didn't want to stick around long enough to finish a beer, and she still felt a little funny about saying the word stone piss to complete strangers. She scanned the shelves behind the bar until her gaze landed on the oddly shaped black bottle in front of the other patron down at the end of the bar. It was made of shiny black glass, wide and round at the bottom, with a long, thin neck that rose diagonally and curved over like a scorpion tail. The stinger-shaped stopper lying next to the bottle suggested that the scorpion imagery had been intentional. She remembered the giant scorpion Professor Goosewaddle had conjured up in her boss's office back in Bay St. Louis, her first introduction to the magic of this world. Perhaps fate had led her here to try this drink.
"What's that guy drinking?" she asked, nodding toward the other patron.
"Scorpion's kiss," said the man at the end of the bar.
"I'm sorry, I thought I was being more discreet."
"It's distilled from the venom of scorpion folk."
The man turned the bottle over and filled his glass. The curved neck made it seem like it would be impossible to pour a shot without spilling half the bottle all over the bar, but he filled the glass to within a hair's breadth of the rim without spilling a single drop.
"See if it suits you."
The glass slid along the bar like they do in the movies, except this guy hadn't touched it. Stacy caught the glass, and a couple of drops sloshed over the rim onto her finger.
"Impressive," the man smiled.
"Thank you."
Stacy's finger tingled where the booze had sloshed onto it. She brought her hand to her mouth and touched the drops with her tongue, which picked up the tingle more immediately.
"Is this stuff okay to drink? You said it's made of venom, right?"
"It's no worse for you than anything in these other bottles. The fatal properties of the venom itself are neutralized in the distillation process, but it provides something of an exhilarating sensation in one's insides."
"Neat."
Stacy swigged back the shot and brought the glass back down on the bar a little harder than she'd meant to. She caught a flicker of annoyance on the bartender's face.
"What do you think?"
asked the man at the end of the bar. Stacy felt that same tingling sensation all the way down her esophagus, then spreading out along the inner walls of her stomach.
"It's like plum-flavored boozy peroxide, except way better than that sounds now that I've said it aloud. Thanks."
She smiled and slid the glass back to him. The drinks must have been affecting her dexterity. The glass didn't make it halfway before sliding right off the bar and smashing into shards on the floor.
"Oops!"
"Unbelievable," said the bartender, not even trying to mask her contempt.
"I'm sorry," said Stacy. "I'll clean it up." "You've done enough. I've got it."
Stacy wondered what kind of dire beast crawled up this bitch's ass. She could appreciate that it was not an ideal time of day to be awake and serving liquor to obnoxious drunks like herself, and she understood what a pain in the ass broken glass was to clean up, trying to make sure every tiny fragment was accounted for so that no one would get hurt. But this was just plain bad customer service. The bartender produced an oddly shaped copper jug from under the bar. It had a pitcher handle on one side, but instead of a spout on the other side, the entire side was flat. She carried it around to the front and upturned it, pouring out a viscous orange ooze which completely covered the glass shards. Leaving the puddle of goop on the floor, she walked through a door at the rear of the establishment, then emerged a few seconds later with a live gray rat in an iron cage barely large enough to contain it.
"Aw," said Stacy. "What's his name?"
The bartender rolled her eyes as she lowered the rat cage into the jug by a steel chain. She tipped the jug over on its flat side next to the ooze, which immediately started to move slowly toward it, then into it. Rat shrieks from inside the jug grew louder, and the rattle of iron against copper grew more frantic as more and more of the ooze crept in. The shrieks spiked up in pitch, then both sounds ceased completely. When the entire mass of ooze was inside the jug, the bartender tilted it back upright. She carried it back behind the bar and set it down in its proper place. She pulled the chain, and it came up with a wet, slurpy sound, suspending an empty iron cage. Stacy was equal parts mesmerized and horrified at the speed with which that ooze was able to liquefy a rat. Remembering what had instigated this spectacle, she looked back down at the floor where she dropped the shot glass. There wasn't a glint of broken glass.
"Do either of you need anything before I go bait the rat trap?"
"I could use a new glass," said the man with the scorpion booze.
The bartender's jaw dropped as she grabbed a new shot glass from under the bar.
I'm so sorry, Darton. Whatever was I thinking?
Fret not, Nadia. You had more urgent responsibilities.
Darton raised a brow at Stacy. Shall I ask for one more glass? Nadia's lips tightened as she conspicuously failed to look in Stacy's direction, and Stacy finally recognized the bug up her ass. Nadia wasn't in a rotten mood because of her shitty job. She was being territorial about this Darton guy she was into, and didn't appreciate Stacy and her sizzling hot 18 charisma score moving in on her man. Was it not enough that Stacy had dragged a guy into the bar with her? She supposed it wasn't, not if Darton was buying her drinks right under Nadia's nose. That was worse than rejection. That was complete indifference to Nadia's feelings. That is, of course, if he'd even picked up on those feelings in the first place. Stacy had no interest in getting between this bitchy bartender or her coveted sugar wizard, and she saw a potential opportunity to expedite the results of her gather information skill.
No, I'd better not. I really just came in to ask a question and be on my way.
Oh, said Nadia, suddenly much more attentive and perhaps not friendlier, but at least less openly hostile.
What would you like to know? I'm looking for some dice. The game parlors are concentrated more on the other side of the strip. Thank you for coming in.
Nadia was definitely ready to get Stacy out the door, and more than willing to spill her guts to make that happen. Now all Stacy needed to do was refine her question.
What I meant was, I'm looking for some special dice.
Nadia looked Stacy up and down.
Listen, honey, I can see you've got some moxie and good for you, but if you walk into a game parlor on the Crescent Shadow and try to play with loaded dice, you're not going to walk back out with all your fingers.
Darton nodded. Nadia is correct. They take that sort of thing very seriously. You would be well advised to not try to swindle them.
Stacy's question refinement process needed refinement.
I'm not trying to swindle anyone. I'm not interested in any game parlors. Christ, I grew up in Biloxi. I've seen grown men and women shit their pants rather than walk away from a slot machine long enough to go to the bathroom. That's not for me. The dice I'm looking for are more ornamental.
She pulled the dragon claw pendant out of the pocket she'd been keeping it hidden in, all the while keeping a wary eye on Darton, ready to leap over there and break his nose if he tried to cast a spell or anything.
That one glass will be fine, Nadia, said Darton, without taking his eyes off the die. Go and see to your rat trap.
Nadia looked like a puppy that had just been kicked in the gut.
Sure.
Shoulders slumped, she trudged through the back door. Darton stepped toward her and raised his hand cautiously toward the die, indicating that while he'd like to touch it, he was aware that attempting to do so might result in a broken nose.
May I?
Stacy shook her head.
Sorry, this is too important. Look, but don't touch.
Darton peered at the pendant.
The craftsmanship of the silver leaves something to be desired, but the gem itself is exquisite. What kind of stone is that?
I don't know.
Stacy wrapped the chain around the pendant and put it back in her pocket. But there are five more of them floating around out there, and it's very important that I acquire them. They might be mounted on jewelry like this one. It could be a pendant, maybe a brooch, or, I don't know, a belt buckle?
Or on the head of a cane?
Asked Darton, pouring himself another shot of Scorpion's Kiss.
Exactly. Way to think outside the box. Or it might even be on a set of a... Hang on a minute. Did you actually see one mounted on the head of a cane?
Earlier this very evening, an old colleague of mine, Alaric of Whitewood, was flaunting a newly acquired walking cane with just such a stone mounted at the top.
Someone you know? Said Stacy.
A friend of yours? More like a business rival. If you don't mind me asking, how much do you know about these dice, as you refer to them?
Not much, said Stacy. I just know that I need them to get me and my friends back.
Should she say home or to our home world? Lest she seem like she was having a stroke mid-sentence, she chose one.
A home? Where do you live? Perhaps a simple teleport spell might work just as well.
Stacy refrained from sighing. Should have gone with our home world.
I don't really have time to explain why that's not going to work. The longer the dice are out of my possession, the more difficult they'll be to track down. If you got any information as to where I can find this Alaric of Whitewood, I'd be very grateful. Otherwise, I'll have to be on my way.
Finding him won't be a problem. He's staying at the Starlight. But I'm curious as to how you intend to walk away from him
with both that cane and your life. A wizard is wont to be very protective of a prize like that.
I'll figure that out when I have to, said Stacy. After all, I've managed to get one back already.
I admit to being intrigued, and wonder if I might offer guidance, or perhaps some behind-the-scenes assistance.
If Stacy had learned anything about the Crescent Shadow, she knew that Darton sought more than satisfied curiosity in exchange for risking his neck by helping to steal from a fellow wizard.
And what would you require from me for your guidance and behind-the-scenes assistance?
Darton downed his drink.
I'll figure that out when I have to.
Nadia reemerged from the back room with a tray full of sparkling champagne flutes, which she set on the counter and began hanging upside down on a rack.
Where are you staying? Darton asked Stacy.
We've only just arrived on the island, Stacy lied. We haven't sorted out our accommodations yet.
I have plenty of room in my suite for both of you. Perhaps we could retire there to continue our conversation.
Stacy didn't want to kick Nadia in the face while she was down, but she had to take the fastest route toward getting those dice back.
That sounds wonderful. Thank you.
The sound of cracking glass came from behind the bar, followed by the sound of glass shattering on the floor. Nadia turned around, exposing her bleeding palm. Stacy gasped, feeling like a soulless bitch.
Nadia, are you all right?
I'm fine, said Nadia. Just a little accident. Occupational hazard. Happens all the time.
She brought the ooze bucket out and poured the orange slime creature on the floor.
Looks like Slimy's lucky day. Can I get anything else for you before I go wash my hands and get another rat?
Put this on my tab, said Darton.
He stoppered his scorpion-shaped bottle.
And put this back in my private nook when you're done.
Stacy would have told him which of his private nooks he could put it in, but Nadia made a Herculean effort to smile and not cry.
Of course, Darton. I look forward to your next visit.
Chapter 26. When an obnoxiously loud bell finally finished clanging, Captain Longfellow's first mate, Alexei, accompanied Catherine, Randy, and Denise to the cargo hold. The curfew bell, Alexei explained, didn't necessarily signify that folks must stay in their cabins for the night, nature calls when she will, and all that, but rather it signified the beginning of the time during which, if one were to fall overboard, no search and rescue attempts would be made. Whether it was meant to be taken at face value, or there was some underlying threat in there that Catherine didn't understand, it was effective enough such that it was now safe to feed Basil without raising any eyebrows.
"We are to be in and out as quickly as possible," said Alexei, with an almost imperceptible wink at Randy. "These are the captain's orders."
His tone was now more serious.
"I shall keep my eyes on the cabins, lest anyone should wander too close. You feed the beast and close the hatch. Are we clear?"
Catherine and Randy nodded, while Denise gave him a jerk-off gesture. Once Alexei showed her how to operate the winch, which lowered the ramp to the cargo hold, Denise finally proved useful for something. Catherine held the bag open, but allowed Randy the privilege of reaching into it and pulling out rat corpses. Basil did some groaning, and Randy whispered him some encouraging words, but the whole process was over in less than 5 minutes, leaving the four of them standing awkwardly at the rear of the ship. At least Catherine felt awkward. She guessed that Randy and Alexei would have liked some alone time, but she was in no hurry to get back to their cabin, especially if it meant that she would be having some alone time with Fragnar, their assigned fourth cabin mate. Fragnar was a beast of a man. Catherine couldn't tell if he was a half-orc or just a really meaty and ugly full-blooded human. He had the look of someone who had done a lot of hard time and for whom life on the outside was even harder. Still, Catherine thought Denise would have had a go at him.
"I'm surprised you decided to join us," Catherine said to Denise, breaking the silence. "Is Fragnar not your type?"
From her observations so far, she'd narrowed Denise's type down to anything with a dick. Denise rested her bearded chin on her forearms on the ship's railing and sighed.
"Oh, I ain't his. He said he was put off by my consent."
Wanting to give Randy and his new friend some privacy, but not yet ready to fall asleep in a cramped room with two rapists, Catherine decided to see if she could squeeze any information from Captain Longfellow. He seemed to have taken a shine to her, but also mindful of his boundaries, and in the event that he wasn't so mindful, she'd have Butterbean there with her.
"I'm going to go for a walk,"
she said to no one in particular.
All right, said Randy. Be careful. There's some unsavory-looking folks on board this ship. You sure you don't want Denise to go with you?
Catherine smiled at him sympathetically. She only gave so much of a shit about his privacy.
No, that's okay. I've got Butterbean to protect me.
Randy looked broken-hearted, so Catherine gave it a last-ditch effort.
Hey, Denise, did you tell Fragnar you're pregnant?
Denise raised her head and turned around.
No? You reckon that would help?
Catherine shrugged.
If fucked up shit is what turns him on, I reckon poking his dick into a womb full of scorpion babies might be worth running by him.
She mentally crossed, use the word reckon in a sentence off her bucket list.
Just don't come on too strong.
I'm one step ahead of you, said Denise. I'm going to tell him that I had second thoughts on account of I think it might be unhealthy for the babies. That way, he'll think it's rape.
Wow, that's a whole new level of fucked up. Good luck with that.
After Denise had waddled off toward their cabin, Catherine took her leave from Randy and Alexei. When she got to the ladder leading up to the captain's quarters, she held the bag of holding open for Butterbean.
It's just until I get up the ladder. I won't be more than a couple of minutes, I promise.
Butterbean whimpered a token objection, but walked into the open bag. On her way up, Catherine kept her mind distracted from the boat's rocking, which was more pronounced the higher she climbed, by thinking about the ethical ramifications of what Denise had proposed. Rape by deception was certainly a reprehensible thing, and she never imagined she'd have to qualify that by adding, under most circumstances. But if the victim's only grievance was that he wasn't committing genuine rape when he'd been led to believe he was that really such a bad thing? Having reached the captain's quarters at the top of the ladder, Catherine decided she no longer gave a shit. She knocked on Captain Longfellow's door.
Who dare be disturbing me slumber? It's such a late hour.
The captain boomed as his heavy footsteps approached the door.
It's Catherine, the one with the unusual cargo.
The door swung open. Captain Longfellow was wearing a dark green silk robe embroidered with purple dragons breathing orange plumes of fire. It was tied loosely around his waist, revealing an impressive collection of scars and tattoos covering his mostly exposed chest. His heavy eyelids and rum-soaked breath suggested that he was well started on the night's drinking.
Do ye mean to say exceptional booty?
Catherine gave him a warning glare.
It be a nautical term. How might I be of service?
I just needed to get out of my cabin and wondered if you'd be up for some time-killing conversation.
Count me honored. This such a salty old urchin like meself come to your mind.
He stood aside, holding the door open.
Do come in.
He poked his head out, presumably to see if Catherine was accompanied by anyone else.
For all the danger and peaks of excitement, a life at sea has long lulls of monotony. Swapping tales with strange folk can keep a land-footed lass like yourself from developing the madness that so many a young God's almighty.
He'd obviously not expected to see a wolf staring back at him when he turned around. The stuffy air smelled like a cross between an antique shop, a cigar shop, and a locker room. Shelves along the walls were filled with exotic-looking junk. There were statues of wood and bronze, musical instruments and decorative pieces of weaponry and armor, chalices and skulls of man and beast, even a chalice which appeared to have been crafted from a man's skull. Catherine took a seat at the table which occupied most of the length of the room.
Sorry about that. I didn't mean to startle you.
She stroked Butterbean's head.
I find that Butterbean keeps men on their most gentlemanly behavior.
I have no doubt.
Captain Longfellow grabbed two dusty shot glasses from a shelf, then took a seat across the table from Catherine and Butterbean and poured brown liquid from a bottle into each. He slid one glass across the table to her, then raised his. Catherine ignored both the dust and the fact that the captain had obviously been drinking straight from the bottle prior to her arrival. It went down smooth and felt good in her blood.
Be there anything in particular weighing on your mind, Lady Catherine?
Tell me what you know about the Ice Queen of Nazir.
Captain Longfellow gave her a half-smile as he poured the next round.
This be your idea of time-killing conversation, does it?
Everybody's been making such a big deal out of her. I just want to have some kind of idea what I'm up against.
Catherine raised her glass, initiating the next drink. The captain obliged, and they necked their shots back.
I know not but rumors of the woman herself. but I've seen firsthand the effects of her wicked sorcery. When I was but a cabin boy on me uncle's ship, the Penetrator, Nazir was a popular destination for we seafaring folk whose business dealings didn't always align with the laws of the land folk. Bless me, Barnacles, I wasn't there at the time, but the stories from those who managed to escape say that on the day she arrived, the whole bloody island turned from tropical paradise to frozen wasteland overnight, trapping ships in the harbor and enslaving all those aboard to construct her massive palace of ice.
Sounds like a bitch. Catherine fidgeted with her glass. As appreciative as she was for the captain spilling his guts, she wished he'd start spilling some rum again as well.
That's not the worst of it. One island in an ocean full of them is no great loss. As much as it saddens me to lose so many fine seaworthy men, a life at sea soon teaches ye that sometimes ye need to cut your losses rather than let the drowning drag ye down to the depths with them.
His gaze fell to her hand.
Where be me manners?
He filled both their glasses. Oh, you don't have to. Thanks. Catherine gulped back her shot. You were saying? Captain Longfellow poured her another before continuing.
Her curse upon the sea spreads outward from Nazir a few miles more with every passing year. In the next half century, it's expected that the entire southeast passage will be frozen over completely, which would not only cut off trade to the southern islands, but would also set her frozen minions loose on the lands of men.
Couldn't the king send a swarm of dragons or something to go evaporate her icy ass?
No point in it while the trade routes are still open. That be the next king's problem.
But what happens when her frozen minions get loose on the lands of men or whatever? Why not take care of the problem now while they can still contain it?
You got sperm in your ears, lass? Or did it not speak clearly enough before?
The captain's frustration with the very same question was evident in his tone. Catherine knew better than to take it personally. She raised her glass. The next king's problem. Captain Longfellow sighed, then clinked his glass against hers.
Aye, next king's problem.
Chapter 27.
Where am I?
Said Cooper, shielding his eyes against the piercing daylight.
Jesus, what time is it?
You have slept just over an hour,
responded a childlike voice that sounded like one of those goddamn wild pigs who'd abducted him, Chaz, and Goatman. Cooper rubbed some shit out of his eyes while they adjusted to the light.
Don't fuck with me, pig. It was only evening when you worked your sleep magic on me. It's gotta be at least late morning now or early afternoon even. Hang on. Did you violate me?
We are not pigs.
I'm sorry. Is that like the N-word to your kind? Do you prefer to be called swine or porcine American or something?
Now that his eyes had adjusted to the light, he searched the grove to address the pig he was talking to. But the only living creatures he could see were Chaz and Goatman, both still sound asleep.
Where the hell are you?
A tiny winged person materialized in front of Cooper, hands on her hips, hovering and glaring at him like an angry bee.
Jesus fucking Christ!
Do I look like a pig to you?
No,
Cooper admitted.
It was an honest mistake. You sound just like the pigs that abducted me and my two traveling companions.
The boar were just pulling the sleds. We were the ones talking to you. We can turn invisible at will.
Cooper thought about it for a moment. In light of seeing this tiny flying woman hovering in front of his face, her explanation seemed a lot more credible than him being kidnapped by talking pigs.
Shit. Please apologize to that one pig I beat the shit out of.
I'm sure he will understand when I explain to him how incredibly stupid you are.
Thanks.
With that weight off his chest, Cooper took in his surroundings. While it was as bright as mid-afternoon in their immediate surroundings, the light didn't come from the sky, but from an orange crystalline structure on the ground like a frozen campfire. It shined light like Chaz's acorn had, only much more intensely, but the full moon and stars were visible in the night sky.
Where are we?
This is the secret glade of Glitter Sprinkles Grove.
How fucking secret could this place be all lit up like this? It's got to be visible for miles.
We've cast permanent image spells all along the perimeter of the glade. To the outside observer, this looks like any other random section of dark forest. Occasionally, A dark one will wander in by chance, but we make short work of them. Now tell me, what business you have in my wood?
I'm not interested in your wood,
said Cooper.
As a matter of fact, I thought you were a woman.
The effeminate flying creature glowered like it might slap him, so he hurried to his point.
We were looking for you. You're pixies, right?
Your powers of perception are developing. You can now tell the difference between a pig and a pixie. Congratulations. Now, what further trouble do you seek to cause for the children of the forest, half-orc?
I don't seek shit. I was led here by a friend of yours, someone by the name of Nobby.
The impressively convincing pixie transvestite's pink eyebrows furrowed in thought.
Nobby? That doesn't ring any chimes. Is he a gnome?
Hollywhirl,
said a second pixie, who suddenly appeared, grabbing the first one by the arm. This one also had very effeminate features, but was more obviously a dude. He turned to Cooper with a wide-eyed gaze.
Do you mean Nobby?
Shit,
Cooper sighed.
Am I still fucking up the pronunciation?
Hollywhirl pulled his arm free from the other's grasp and had a tiny arrow aimed at Cooper's face before he even saw him pull out a bow.
What know you of my sister, filthy half-orc? Speak the truth, or I'll feed you to the Dark Ones before I destroy you for good.
Dude was pissed, but Cooper found it kind of adorable that he was threatening him with such a tiny arrow.
Listen, man, I don't want any...
A mass of black feathers launched out from one of the trees at the perimeter of the glade, like a particularly obnoxious dark one with a beak. Hollywhirl spun around and released his bowstring, interrupting Ravenous's battle squawk and sending him crash-landing into the grass next to Cooper.
Nice try, buddy,
said Cooper to the unconscious bird.
It was a solid effort.
Search the perimeter,
demanded Hollywhirl to the seemingly empty air.
See if anyone else was following them.
It was just him,
said Cooper.
To be honest, I'd forgotten he was with us.
We shall soon find out, Mr. Cooper.
Cooper's heart skipped a beat as he stared in wonder at the effeminate bug man.
How do you know my name?
Are you deaf?
Said Hollywhirl.
Your stupid bird just shouted it.
Cooper looked down at Ravenous, feeling even worse for having forgotten about him.
He speaks the elven tongue. I can't understand any of the shit he says.
Hollywhirl's face was a mixture of impatience, frustration, confusion, and, as hard as Cooper searched for it, a distinct lack of an Adam's apple.
Why would you choose for your familiar to speak a language which you cannot understand?
Cooper snorted.
My familiar? Do I look smart enough to be a fucking wizard to you?
No, you do not.
And do I look like I have a high enough charisma score to be a sorcerer?
Cooper let loose the fart that had been brewing from the anxiety of the interrogation to strengthen his point. Hollywhirl and his visible companion flew a few feet higher.
I'm not sure I understand what you're talking about,
said Hollywhirl.
But if not your familiar, then whose? The human weakling? The satyr?
It's a friend of mine's. We got separated. I'm looking after him until we meet back in Cardinia. Nabi requests we make this detour into a fucking haunted forest. If she's really your sister, then I'm sure you know how stubborn and persuasive she is.
Cooper was expecting a sleep arrow to the face, which would have suited him fine. But Hollywhirl's hard glare began to soften.
I sense no ill intent from you, and you genuinely seem too dumb to deceive.
Thank you.
Where is my sister?
She's in my axe.
Hollywhirl frowned.
I don't understand.
I don't either,
said Cooper.
I picked up this badass-looking axe off an orc I killed out on the Barrier Islands. Couple of days later, it started talking to me, like, in my mind. It said its name is Nabi, and started going ape shit on creatures it considered evil. She's fucking exhausting.
That does sound like your sister,
said the other pixie, a little judgmentally.
She tends to be a bit zealous.
Hollywhirl's eyes sparkled a little more than tears alone should account for, like his tear ducts were secreting glitter glue.
Honeydrop, Wildflower, fetch the half-orc's axe.
Right away, Hollywhirl,
said a voice from the air above Cooper. A few moments later, Cooper's axe floated sideways and lay on the ground in front of him. He sat extra still, wanting to be absolutely clear that he had no intention of picking it up and swinging it at them.
Hickory Nut, can fell a sparrow in flight from 30 yards away,
said Hollywhirl, gesturing at his visible companion. His tone wasn't hostile, but it wasn't fucking around either.
You are far larger, slower, and nearer. And he's not the only one with an arrow currently pointed at you.
Cooper glanced around, not seeing anyone, but also not doubting his words.
I understand.
Nubby?
Hollyworld addressed the axe.
Are you in there?
After a moment of no response, even in Cooper's head, Hollyworld looked sternly at him.
I think I need to hold her,
said Cooper.
Our bond needs to strengthen or something.
He was kind of talking out of his ass, but he also believed that what he was saying was true in a way that he didn't fully comprehend. Hickory Nut's expression was skeptical, but Hollyworld's was hopeful.
Very well,
said Hollyworld.
Pick up the axe.
Instead of flying higher as Hickory Nut did, Hollyworld descended and landed gently on the ground in front of Cooper and the axe. Cooper didn't know if it was meant to convey that he trusted him or to show off just how unafraid of him he was, like he was daring Cooper to make a wrong move. Maybe he just wanted to show off to his own people who really had the nuts of Hickory.
Hollyworld,
said Hickory Nut, sounding a little concerned.
It's okay.
Hollyworld's gaze never left Cooper's.
He knows he's surrounded.
Well, he sure as shit knows now. Cooper scooted forward on his ass in order to demonstrate that he was not at all trying to get into an optimal battle-ready stance. It was due for a wipe anyway. When he reached the axe, he moved his hands very slowly and deliberately toward the upper part of the shaft, near the blades, so as to purposely not have leverage for a swing.
Now, B?
You've done well, Cooper. Thank you.
Oh, you're welcome. Your brother is here.
Hollyworld's eyes narrowed and his lips pursed, but he remained still and silent.
I don't have a brother.
Cooper kept his circumstances in mind, but glared at Hollyworld.
You son of a bitch, imposter! Who are you?
Hollyworld is my sister.
Well, she had you fooled too, huh?
Cooper cupped his hands around the corner of his mouth, brought the axe blades up close to his face, and whispered,
He asked me what I wanted to do with his wood.
I asked you what business you have in my wood, you idiot. That's another word for forest.
Cooper felt embarrassed that she'd hurt him, but relieved because he'd fully intended to rub one out to her later, whether she was a dude or not.
Sorry, never can tell nowadays.
If that axe is really my sister, ask her why she's an axe.
Cooper listened to Nabi's story in his head, then relayed it, piece by piece, to the pixie audience.
She sensed an evil presence in the wood.
He paused to snort out a giggle and snot bubble. When it was clear that no one else shared his amusement, he continued.
She discovered a dwarf leading a group of goblins and decided to follow them. They went deep into... Hang on, are you fucking with me?
What is it?
Asked Hollyworld.
Where did they go?
Morning Glory Hole?
Again, there was a distinct absence of laughter.
Yes?
Hollyworld motioned for him to continue.
That's a real place?
Said Cooper.
Morning Glory Hole?
It's a cave to the south,
said Hickory Nut.
And that's the best name you could come up with for it?
It's named for all the morning glories which grow around it.
Cooper frowned.
It doesn't seem a little...
Who gives a juniper berry what the cave's name is?
Said Hollyworld.
What happened next?
After pausing to listen, Cooper continued with Nabi's story.
Though she was invisible, the dwarf had been aware of her presence all along. He cast a web spell at the cave's entrance, trapping the bee and rendering her helpless.
Hollyworld folded her arms and huffed.
That's just like her, to go off on her own without telling anyone and follow evil creatures into a forbidden cave.
When they captured her, the goblins held her down.
Hollyworld and Hickory Nut's eyes grew wide with worry and anticipation as Cooper developed a sick feeling in his stomach, fearing what information he might shortly have to relay aloud.
The dwarf grinned down at her, commanding the goblins to turn her over, then...
He pulled my wings off. Cooper sighed with relief.
Whew, he just pulled her wings off.
Hollyworld and Hickory Nut gasped in horror, as did several other pixies who still chose to remain invisible.
I thought that story was headed in a whole different direction,
said Cooper.
But yeah, I guess that's still pretty bad.
Continue with your story, Half-Orc,
said Hollyworld, staring daggers at him, as if he was the one who de-winged her sister.
The dwarf performed some kind of ritual and trapped her inside the axe. She took some time to adjust to being an axe, and by the time she got control of her senses, she was in some kind of orc stronghold. She held back her power a few times, killing the owners by giving them a disadvantage in combat until...
Until what?
Asked Hickory Nut. Cooper knew this was going to be a hard sell.
Until she met me.
Hollywhirl narrowed her eyes.
Why? What's so special about you that Nabi would choose you to wield her?
You have a good heart. You are loyal to your friends.